Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutin.
Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Today at dawn, Singapore executed Abdul Kahar bin Uthman, an 68-year-old prisoner convicted of drug trafficking. It was the city-state's first execution in 2 years. This comes just the day after Singapore courts rejected an appeal against the execution of Malaysian national Nagendra Damalingam, dismissing the argument put forward by his legal team that he should be spared because he is mentally impaired. Joining us on the line now, N. Surendran, advisor to the NGO Lawyers for Liberty. He is also the lawyer representing Nagendran's family. Surendran, I'm just wondering, in the case of Nagendran, is this the point of no return for him? Is his execution imminent?
The legal avenues to save Nagendran have, I think, come to an end. We can safely say that. It has been going on since November last year when the first execution notice was issued. And with the dismissal yesterday, I think the legal avenues have ended. But, yes, it could be that the execution could be carried out sooner rather than later. We just don't know what the intention of the Singapore authorities are. And that in itself is an illegality and a cruelty, because it keeps, things in doubt, and it puts the family through a great deal of suffering and fear. But having said that, I think there's still a lot of room to stop this execution from going forward. There has been international attention on this case particularly because of Nagendran's mental disability. Our position is that he's a person with IQ 69, he has a mental disability. He must not be executed because it is in breach of international law and Singapore's own law.
A little insight into why you call this a kind of form of mental torture, just to kind of paraphrase you. Somebody on death row, not knowing when they're going to be executed, every day, potentially their last day. How do we even measure the kind of, immense emotional pressure, psychological pressure that puts on the person who's going to be executed?
Yeah, I mean, it is impossible for us to imagine what the prisoners on death row go through and what their families go through. You are living every day under a sentence of death, and not any kind of death, but a brutal, painful, awful death. And prisoners I've spoken to over the years in Changi Prison. When someone is being executed, let's say on that Friday morning, and when the lever is pulled and the person drops through the trap door, the noise is so loud, that awful noise, that everyone else on death row can hear it. All of them are lying there at that 6 a.m. listening to that horrible sound, that I think pierces through their very souls. So it is cruelty beyond belief, and that is why I think the people living a few centuries away will look back on our time now and think, what barbarism is this?
That sounds horrific, Surendran. Can I ask you about the chances for a pardon, for clemency? What is the likelihood of clemency being granted?
Well, we say that clemency ought to be granted in this case, because not only has he IQ 69. But at the time when he was arrested and he was processed through and brought to trial, Singapore had no system of accommodation, what you call procedural accommodation, to deal with a person with his level of mental disability. So can you imagine, you put someone like Nagin with 69 IQ, half a dozen policemen in the room questioning him, taking down his statements, then you bring those statements to court, and you convict him on that basis. And you've got the court judgment coming and saying that Nagendran gave conflicting statements, etc., etc. Melissa, Sharad, Mice, and the three of us can draw on our own common experience living and having come across people with such low IQ, that there is no way that they can deal with that situation, that there's no way that they can have got due process or fair trial. And nothing, no special assistance or no accommodation was made for Nagendran from day one, which is why we have been saying he's been denied due process. But the response from the Singapore authorities is always to say that he had his day in court. It is wrong to say. It's wrong to say that.
Well, so, but I'm just wondering, I mean, has Singapore historically given pardons or clemency to convicts on death row?
Melissa, I think for the past, if I am not entirely wrong, I think for the past almost three decades, I think there was maybe one clemency, if I'm not mistaken. For the past 20 years or more, no one gets clemency basically in Singapore. Once you're convicted, the clemency is a pointless exercise, and then off you go to the gallows. But we are saying that in this case, and in any case, in fact, involving mental disability, the government must invoke the mechanism of clemency. They still have room. Singapore still has room to advise their president. The government should advise the president to grant clemency in this case. Yesterday morning, when his final appeal was dismissed, my colleague M. Ravi was in court. He spoke to him, and Nagendran had no idea that meant that he's going to execution. He had no idea. He has no clue what is happening. So how do you execute a person like that? Isn't this a fit and proper case for clemency?
Can I ask you if public pressure might help Nagendran's case? We understand that this case has attracted global attention, from multiple quarters. Might international pressure, public pressure, media pressure help Nagendran's case at this point?
Melissa, that is the only thing that we have left. And I think it can make a difference. Because we saw the kind of global outrage there was on behalf of Nagendran starting last November. And we had even prominent personalities like Richard Branson and others speaking out. And we had a lot of outrage both in Singapore and also in Malaysia. And to give credit to the Prime Minister and the King, they intervened in unprecedentedly and wrote to their counterparts and tried to help Nagin. But more can be done by the government. It's not enough. And I think if others can speak out, overseas, I hope more prominent people within our country also can speak up.
What can I ask you? What his family and his loved ones can expect in the run-up to his execution?
Since November, and even before that, we had actually raised Nagendran's case way before the execution notice came out on 10 November. They have been very determined to try and stop this execution. They know the problems that their loved one faces, and they've tried their very best, but they need support. They need support. And, right now they're in fear because they don't know how long they have with him. They face a lot of obstacles and hurdles going back and forth from Malaysia to Singapore to visit him. And they're just trying everything, seeking support everywhere to try and stop this execution. And it's a terrible time for them because every day they're fearing they're going to get that fresh letter of execution, which could come like a bolt out of the blue at any point of time. It's a terrible. I spoke to his sister yesterday. She was in tears because the appeal had been dismissed, asking me what more can we do. We need to do something. So I think that's the terrible situation of the families. And if this thing happens, the horror of this, they will have to live with it for a very long time. It will never leave them. I've dealt with other families over the past two decades. And it changes the entire family when something like this happens. Death by hanging is the worst kind of horror to be perpetrated over not just the victim, but the family members.
Surendran, thank you so much for joining us on the show. And Surendran from Lawyers for Liberty. We're going to take a quick break here on Consider This. We will be back with more on this topic in just a couple of minutes. Stay tuned.
Berikan khasiat untuk keceriaan berpanjangan. Kongsikan kebaikan agar kegembiraan diteruskan. Hulurkan pertolongan agar senyuman dapat diraihkan. Capaikan tangan demi kasih yang berterusan. Hulurkan kebaikan dan ia pasti berterusan. Good day, kebaikan diteruskan.
Konspirasi Menanti On Demand.
Suami saya mana? Dia tengah nak cari bomoh, kita boleh tipu dia.
Komplot penipuan.
Apa dia?
Kacau.
Siapa nak jawab?
Adunan unsur mistik.
Yang tak ada kita ada pemelut.
Rahsia skandal terbongkar.
Aku akan bunuh siapa yang tolong dia.
Mampukah cabaran diatasi?
Aku jangan.
Stream ke semua siri drama box sets On Demand di Ultrabox dan aplikasi Astro Go.
I tak kacau hidup you, so you jangan kacau hidup I.
Bagi saya habis cakap dulu boleh?
What happened to us?
Cinta menguasai segalanya.
Itu taste Emma kan?
You are not my taste.
Abang pasti ke dia pilihan abang ni?
It's you and me.
Kau kena percaya dengan jodoh.
Cinta dengan drama lebih menarik.
Yeah, I love you.
I love you very, very much. Mostly.
Kontrak niaga harapan minyak sawit mentah MSM di Bursa Malaysia Derivatives mungkin mengalami pembetulan teknikal pada minggu ini. Malaysia Airports Holdings Berhad akan memastikan semua lapangan terbang antarabangsa di bawah seliannya bersedia untuk menerima kemasukan penumpang antarabangsa. Harga minyak dunia susut sedikit pada Rabu selepas Emirat Arab Bersatu UAE berkata ia bersetuju untuk mengeluarkan lebih banyak minyak untuk menyokong bekalan dalam pasaran.
Hi, you're watching Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris. With me is Sharad Kutin. We're discussing Singapore's mandatory death penalty for drug-related offences. This in light of this morning's execution of Abdul Kahar bin Uthman and yesterday's rejection of Malaysian national Nagendran Dharmalingam's death penalty appeal. Joining us on the show now, we have Dobby Chu. He is executive coordinator at the Anti-Death Penalty Asia Network. Dobby, are the arguments that have often been used and used in the past to justify the continued use of the death penalty, you know, arguments of that it is a deterrent, that, you know, it is for justice and for retribution, do all those arguments still hold today?
Yeah, I think if you look at a survey that's done within Malaysia, in Singapore, in Taiwan, in any country, deterrence and retribution is still the main leading factors that people support the death penalty. And for most part, I think a lot of the kind of support for it is still very misguided, as it was in the 70s when they introduced the death penalty for drug offenses specifically. Because back then, their thought was, we have a heroin crisis, Malaysia, Singapore, we are the kind of travel lane for drugs to come out of the Golden Triangle. We need the death penalty to scare off people. It's been about 40 years since this law are in place. And, you know, you still see the drug trade flourishing. You still see record bust, record arrest every year. And it's just, but people still believe and think that it works as a retribution or as a deterrence.
Toby, is there any way that governments can kind of reduce their reliance? And say they're not ready to abolish the death penalty, but they want to somehow work towards that. Are there ways or principles of best practices to kind of mitigate this particular practice?
Yeah, so international consensus-wise, I think has made it very clear. Right now, the death penalty for most part is accepted only for what we call crime, most serious crime, where it's intentional murder or something that carries intentionally harming someone with grave consequences. Usually it involves something of taking a life or many lives and things of that sort. And drug offenses has, for most part, in most
acceptable for death penalty to take place. And Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore, we are one of those outliers that still insist on carrying the death penalty for drug offenses. And even beyond that, if you look at the trend over the world in the recent years, and I'm not even talking about, you know, progressive European or America or things like that, but even like Vietnam, for example, has been scaling down on the death penalty to ensure that death penalty is not applied to someone who is considered juvenile, pregnant woman. All this kind of restriction essentially is highlighting one thing. If someone is vulnerable and they're at risk, you shouldn't execute that. And mental disability or psychosocial disability is also one of those on the list. So it's one of those things you see the trend everywhere in the world is going down and gradually restricting. Even in Malaysia, when we amended our Dangerous Drug Act back in 2018 under Barisan Nasional, the idea was we know there are people who don't deserve the death penalty that were caught in the crossfire. So how do we reduce that? And we try to amend a lot to reach that, right? It's not perfect, but it's a step forward. Singapore also tried to do it in their own laws in 2013-14, but what we see now is there's still a shortfall to it, and they're not owing up to their responsibility yet.
Okay, well, I want to refer to the headlines in the news, the recent execution of Abdul Qahar, the denial, the rejection of the death penalty appeal for Nagendran. What do those two cases represent to you or highlight to you, Dobby, about the issues with the criminal justice system in Singapore?
So to me, it's a misfiring of the law, so to speak. These laws, when you look at how they're debated in parliament, be it Malaysia or Singapore, Indonesia, is identical, actually. It is to say that we have a big drug trafficking issue. There are people that's profiting off it. There are people that are exploiting off it. And these are the drug kingpins, the big fish that we want to deal with. And the proof or the whole point of this law is to make sure that we can tackle them, we can find them, arrest them, prosecute them, and eventually execute them and essentially wipe them off the face of the world, right? But what's happening when you look at these cases, and anyone can just pick up the judgment. Singapore has made it very easily accessible. You can pick up the judgment and read
people who are carrying a lot of drugs. They are not the ones who are manufacturing it. They are not the people who are designating ABC would be the drug meal for today and you bring how many kilograms of drugs into the country. Most of them, when they are identified, arrested, and the drug tested, most of them are very small quantities and they are definitely what we call mules where they are made to carry things in. In Abdul Qahar's case, of course, it's a bit different. In his case, the facts of the case kind of put him as what we call a small-time dealer, I would say. Someone that has small amount of quantity of drugs and he sells it and resells it, sort of things. But when you look at it, you see the big fish that Parliament in Singapore is trying to address. Is killing him or is executing him going to suddenly put an end to the drug trade? And to me, when I look at this, that's just what I can feel. What is this achieving? Nothing. The drug trade still goes on tomorrow. Today, Qahar got executed. Tomorrow, someone's going to step into his shoe. There's still the need for drugs. People still want to consume drugs. The drug trade still flourishes. So what have we achieved at the end of the day? We would have executed a 60-year-old man, and we may be on track to execute someone who is intellectually disabled. But at the end of the day, there's nothing to show for it.
And Dobby, is it one of the, I think, strategies by states that are committed to the use of a capital punishment is the need to demonize those that they want to basically kill. And they do that by inflating the harm they do to society by painting them, in the case of Nagendran, as a criminal mastermind. You know, I wonder if you notice the rhetorical strategies of states committed to using the death penalty in support of this particularly heinous and inhumane practice.
So this is a part that I find interesting because I think when you look at Malaysia or even China or even Saudi Arabia, they don't really try to paint a narrative anymore. They understand this is not nice, it's not good, it's not something you want to be proud of. Singapore is the only one that's still seemingly on the track to say that the death penalty is the best thing we ever had. It's the best tool we have to combat serious crimes and drug trafficking and the likes. And they do try to paint them as big shot criminals to kind of justify why they must die. And most of the time, if I'm very blunt about it, it backfires on them. And they try to paint Nagendran as this very adept drug mule. He navigates through things, he tries to lie, he tries to cover for himself and make up excuses and things like that. And when someone who is not part of the investigation or part of the prosecution, you look at the kind of transcript that he has, it doesn't make sense. You can see there's something not quite right with this fellow. For example, there's one thing that I keep going back to when I'm reading his judgment. At some point, the prosecution essentially asked him, this guy strapped a bag of drugs to your thigh. Did you not think that he was using you as a drug mule? And his answer was, no, I don't think so. He didn't look like that kind of guy.
what kind of rational adult person would think that way when someone straps a bag of drugs to their thigh? So it's the kind of thing, when they try to portray him as a mastermind, we just point out small tidbits like this and people can read. I don't even need to manufacture a story. It's just there itself. And people see and understand that this is not what the government is saying. And when this happens, I think that power balance got flipped. And then suddenly, it's not the government who is demonizing them to make them larger than life to be executable, so to speak. But it becomes somewhat of a victim that you realize the government is overreaching, trying to achieve what they think is best for their country.
Dobby, thank you for joining us on the show tonight. Dobby Chu from the Anti-Death Panel of the Asia Network. We're going to take another quick break here and consider this. We'll be back with more. Stay tuned.
Saya akan tolong awak cari Darwish.
Serius ah?
Serius.
Ah! Darwish.
That's right.
Ina Karina, mu kena batang macam ni mungkin dia kau.
Tak payahlah.
Macam mana? Dah jumpa dah, dah weather.
Hey. Anja, kalau you tinggalkan I, you takkan senang sampai bila-bila.
Hai! Mana boleh peluk? Kan dosanya tu.
Ini jangan perasan ni. Lagi ni 5 je.
Autumn in Wales. Sewa dan stream on demand atau sila ke saluran 480.
Thanks so much for staying with Sharad and I on Consider This. Today at dawn, the Singapore government carried out its first execution in 2 years, part of its continued use of capital punishment. We speak now to Kristen Han. She's an independent journalist and an anti-death penalty activist. Kristen, the Singapore government says that the death penalty is a major deterrent against drug traffickers. The government claims that the majority of citizens support capital punishment. I'm just wondering about your observations. Are the majority of Singaporeans persuaded by the justifications for the use of capital punishment in the Republic?
Yes, so generally Singaporeans are in favour of the death penalty. However, there was a survey done in 2016 that found that actually when you ask Singaporeans the question in more detail, the level of support for the mandatory death penalty for drug offences, for instance, is actually below 50%. So the government always talks about how Singaporeans are in favour of the death penalty, but actually the mandatory death penalty for drug offences, which is the predominant use case in Singapore, doesn't actually have the public support. So I think a lot of the support that the public says they have for the death penalty is based on a view that's not entirely informed about how it actually works.
Kirsten, is there a generational dimension to the support? Are younger people increasingly aware of global norms and practices and the kind of discourse around the death penalty? Or do they, like their parents, quite support, you know, this rather kind of conservative outlook, you know, law and order above everything else?
Yeah, so we don't have enough of a sort of comprehensive survey more recently to find out what young people think. But just anecdotally and from my observations, I do find that young Singaporeans are much more supportive of the work that we do. So like when we put posts up on Instagram, that we get a lot more engagement and a lot more support, and young people are asking a lot more questions about, you know, inequality and justice and questioning, you know, whether it really works as a deterrent and how this disproportionately affects marginalized communities. So there's a lot more interest in discussing these angles among young Singaporeans than older generations.
Okay. We spoke earlier to a lawyer involved in Nagendran's case, and, you know, he talked about the, I guess, public pressure might help Nagendra's case at this point in time. I'm just wondering about the narratives around around cases like Nagendra and his story. Is the coverage of him, is it being talked about? Is it, do Singaporeans care about the execution of Abdul Kahar this morning? Do Singaporeans care about a mentally impaired man who is on death row, set to be executed?
Yeah, so it is very dependent on what Singaporeans can see on social media, because these narratives and these kind of talking points about Nagin's case, about Kahar's case, are not being reported in the local media. So as far as I've seen today, the local mainstream media has not reported that there has been an execution this morning in Singapore. So if you're not following on social media, if you're not seeing this on your feed, and you're just reading the mainstream media, you probably don't even realize that there has been an execution in Singapore today. So that's very difficult for us to really get huge public momentum, because we're essentially cut out of the mainstream media coverage. And we're only
If I can jump in there, it seems that you know, this is precisely part of the strategy, right, to make these executions invisible. Your involvement and the, you know, Singaporean civil society involvement, are you under a lot of pressure because of your attempts to make visible this practice?
Yes, so it is very difficult to then make visible. We do find that our access and our ability to speak to families and to get messages from the inmates themselves is very challenging. So, for instance, I remember 10 years ago when I worked on the case of Yong Bui Kong, who's a Malaysian, he could write letters out of prison. And today, when family members go and visit the inmates, they are not even allowed to bring paper and pen on their visits. So it can be very difficult to give the inmates their own voice. And then we can only rely on ourselves, essentially, to cover what the mainstream media will know us.
Thank you so much, Kristen, for joining us on the show today and sharing your observations. Singapore-based journalist and activist Kristen Han there, wrapping up this episode of Consider This. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutin, signing off for the evening.
Thank you so much for watching, and good night.
And good night.